From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The stories of Spanish gold in Utah have all the makings of a good legend. There's enough circumstantial evidence to make it seem possible that Spanish miners were finding vast riches in the Utah mountains long before Spanish explorers came here. And there are the accounts of the artifacts, the swords and cannons and bells. Of course, the mines in these stories are always lost, and just in case anyone gets too close, there's a curse. The people who have followed the maps and seen the bullion stacked in caves have all met tragic ends. Today in the program, we're talking about this legend, or the legends of lost gold in Utah. Aside from Spanish gold, there's also Indian gold and Mormon gold, and there are lots of stories to hear and to tell. So we'll talk about it after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we hope you'll consider joining them. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. Visit us online at KUER.org for details. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It's hard to pin down the stories of Spanish gold that have wafted through the generations in the Uinta Basin. But if you've lived in the basin, you've probably heard of the lost gold mines. The Spanish miners once took tons of this precious metal from the Uinta Mountains long before the Spanish explorers arrived. The story has it that these mines were abandoned and lost. But what seems to keep the gold a mystery and the legend in play is a dark curse that hangs over it all. Today in the program, we're telling stories, stories of lost gold in Utah's history. This is more than just Spanish gold in the Uinta Mountains. There are also stories of Indian gold and Mormon gold. Joining us first on the program is Lee Nelson. Lee Nelson is a prolific writer. He stopped counting the titles of his books after 30, he says. He divides his time between fiction and nonfiction. Perhaps he's best known for his series of historical novels called The Storm Testaments, and Lee Nelson is joining us now on the line. Lee Nelson, welcome to the program. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Doug.
How are you?
I'm great today.
Good. I'm referring to a book you wrote, Lee, Storm Gold, and there's a story you tell in the introduction of it about meeting a man by the name of Nick Stevenson, which seems to be the sort of beginning of your experience with the stories of Spanish gold in the Uinta Mountains. Tell that story, if you would.
Yeah. One night late, I get this call from Nick, and I'd never met him before. He just read my book, a biographical novel on the Ute chief Waqara, where I mention Waqara showing Thomas Rhodes where some Indian gold was. And he says, do you want to know that whole story? And I says, sure. He says, come over to Altamont, and I'll take you out in my helicopter. And so I drive over to Altamont, meet him, and up we go in this helicopter. And
what
I
said,
why do we have to do it in a chopper? And he says, well, some of the places we go, the Indians really wouldn't want us there. And he took me over a canyon, and he pointed down into this thick brush, and he says, right there, there's a cave where my father found piles of donkey and mule feet that had been chopped off the animals. And I said, well, what could that possibly mean? And he says, well, they believe that the animals in the afterlife couldn't haul the loot and the gold if their feet were chopped off and hidden and couldn't be resurrected with the main donkey or mule. And that, you know, that was his opinion. Very, very interesting. Then he showed me a place where his father had found a whole bunch of human skulls. And he said he took a couple of them up to the University of Utah, and they said they were not Indian skulls. They were European descent skulls, possibly Spanish. And then he showed me rifle pits and places where battles had taken place. And as I pieced it together after interviewing a number of Indians from the reservation over there, it appeared that there was a huge revolt, Indians against Spaniards, as late as 1840. You know, just a short time before the Mormons arrived, and that many Spaniards were killed and their bodies were thrown down mines and mine shafts. And according to the Indians, they weren't so much concerned the Spaniards taking their gold. They didn't care about that so much, but the Spanish miners were marrying off the best Indian women and taking them as wives without, without consent and without the permission of the males, and they didn't like it, and they decided it was time for the Spanish residency to end. And all these stories, you know, they appear to have legend to them and myth, but you find people that show you crosses on trees. Now, when I do my trail rides, Doug, when I go through Duchesne, I take a little detour there and go over towards Rock Creek, just the entrance, just before the Indian Reservation. We jump the horses out of the trailers, and this is on Indian land, so we have to be a little bit careful. But it's not very far. We ride across an old Indian racetrack and come to these ledges where there's a perfect Spanish cross carved on a rock face, and it's black with water stain. It's obviously very old. It has kind of an old English cursive style to the letters GB on the side of it. And, you know, maybe somebody's buried there. Maybe it's a marker that's the turn off to Rock Creek. I don't know, but just a fascinating thing to look at and ponder. And you find these things just all over the mountains here in Utah. There's much more history here than what we just commonly know, the Mormons arriving in 1847.
So when you first climb aboard that helicopter with Nick, you were skeptical?
I'd been hearing rumors, and I'd read some of George Thompson's books, Lost Treasures on the Old Spanish Trail, and anybody interested in this subject should read George Thompson. His books are just wonderful. It's just too bad he died, and it seems like so many of the people that get involved in these lost mines of the UN, as they die or end up in prison, there seems to be a curse to it. And I don't know if that's true. I do it for my books and stories and curiosity, and maybe that's why I only seem to have good luck, but I haven't found any gold bars yet.
So was there a point when you became, you say that this is what Nick believed. You say that these are the stories that you hear. When you're in the Uinta Basin, is this part of the mythology, the lore of that place?
Well, the Indians all believe it, but they didn't keep written records. But you talk to interview four or five the Indians with roots, you know, going back to, you know, storytelling from their grandfathers and great-grandfathers, and none of them doubt that. But what, there were a lot of Spaniards in the area, and there's a lot of stories about it. And you know, it has to have some basis in reality. And then, I went to a lecture, a professor at University of Utah. I was talking about lecturing on the old Spanish trail that goes from Santa Fe to Los Angeles and makes a huge detour up to Price. And his comment, well, it was just hard traveling across Arizona, and so they would come up to Price. And you think, well, wait a minute, they had to have a reason. But then you start reading Father Escalante's journal, because they teach in the schools that the first white man to come to Utah was Father Escalante in 1776. And BYU Press publishes his journal, and that's a widely known fact that all the academicians believe. But you read the journal, and when they cross the Colorado River that year, over near Moab, they find an old cottonwood tree, and it has Juan de Rivera carved on it, and it looked very old, and under it the inscription, Viva Jesus. That's not Indian. And it was before Father Escalante by quite a bit. And so, yeah, for the schools to teach that Father Escalante was the first one, is, you know, he proves that wrong in his own journal. And so it's just a lot of the history that we don't know.
So what do you...
Yeah, we find all these strange things in the mountains that start painting a bigger and different picture.
So there's the people who live in the Uinta Basin that you talk to, and some of the members of the Ute tribe that you talk to.
Mm-hmm.
What's the end story here? That there are great caches of gold. That
Caleb Rhodes went to Congress around the turn of the century, and said if you'll partition a huge grant of land away from the Indians so we can file claims on it, he said, I'll pay off the national debt. And this land was situated at the head of the Provo, the Weber, and the Duchesne Rivers, up, you know, the west end of the Uinta mountain range. And eventually Congress did annex that land away from the Indians, but by that time Caleb Rhodes had died. But anywhere you go in any of those canyons, you find old diggings. I mean, you know, get on your horse or mule and head up any trail, and just over the years of doing that, just for pleasure and fishing trips, you find diggings and stone huts and things that just shouldn't be there. And it's just all over.
So where
anybody that spends time in that backcountry starts seeing, oh, wait a minute, there were a lot of people here at one time.
So where
they
have
weren't
you
Mormons and they weren't Indians.
Yeah. Where have you settled, Lee Nelson, in terms of what you believe? Have you come down anywhere in all of that?
Well, a lot of people believe there's a main mine, a sacred mine of the Utes, and that's where the curse comes from. You know, the supposedly the Aztec gold from Mexico City when Cortez was making his conquest there, that the Aztecs hauled a lot of the loot off to the north. It was the first time Cortez captured Mexico City. He had this huge, vast amount of gold, and then he was driven out, and he had to recapture the city. And the second time, much of that wealth was gone, and the legends are that it came north, and Cortez's men followed some of Montezuma's servants that were trying to hide the treasure, and that they caught up with some of them in Recapture Canyon down by Monticello. That's why the canyon's named that. And there's been one instance of a little gold bar being found there. But it ties in with that Spanish history. Mel Fisher, who found all the Spanish galleons in the Mediterranean about 12, 15 years ago, I mean, he died here a couple years ago. And just before his death, he was at Moon Lake, right above Duchesne, with some information he had found in archives over in Spain. Yeah, I believe there were some huge caches here. Whether or not they're still there, I don't know. But there are just so many rumors and legends and stories from so many different places, there has to be some foundation to it.
There are those doubters, and clearly we'll be hearing from some of those today. People who say, you know, that this is, Lee, you know, these have all the markings of a legend, that, you know, the evidence is, there may be some circumstantial evidence, that some of it seems scant, that, you know, a lot of the times you'll hear these kind of oral histories from someone who knew someone who had seen something. How do you react to the idea that this is just, these are people who want to believe this terrific fantasy? How do you react to that idea?
Yeah, some people go overboard, and you know, I have a hard time deciding. Some people just flat want to believe it. Like a guy called me just the day before yesterday, Sunday, and on a real rugged canyon right above my office here, up above Springville, about 2,000 feet up, he said he found some Spanish writings on a rock with a little arrow, and he goes around and he finds this cave, and he says he spent the last month digging it out, that there was first he dug down in some dirt and he found an eagle skeleton without the head on it, and that got him excited, and so he dug down and he hit just a layer of flat rocks, almost like a patio, and he lifted those up, and then there was about a foot of just perfect topsoil under that in a mountain cave, and he dug that out, and then he found a few ashes and a bunch of bone chips, a lot of mule deer bones, and the pieces of antler, and then he finally hit bedrock, the bottom of the cave, and you know, no treasure. So he calls me saying, hey, why would they do that up there? And I says, I don't know. It's your best guess. But, you know, what I like to do is I do things at percentages. I don't know if there's a sacred Ute mine with a shipload of gold in it. I know a lot of people believe there is, and there's some stories and legends that point to that. But I know an engineer from Kennecott told me that they take over $1 million in gold a day out of the Kennecott diggings. So when I run into historians and say, there's no gold in Utah, well, they're nuts. Go out to Kennecott and ask anybody that works there how much gold they dig out every single day. And it's, you know, they could make a new millionaire every day. And you find things like that. And so, yeah, there's gold. You go up Rock Creek behind Provo, and there's just mine diggings everywhere. And up above American Fork, there's mines everywhere. Park City got its start with mines, a lot of silver. And, yeah, there's ore here. And why wouldn't the Spanish find it?
Sounds like you want to believe it.
Well, yeah. I mean, Coronado, when I was in school, they teach how he's this great explorer, that the first man up into the Great Plains and discovered all this new country. He was looking for gold. He wasn't trying to be a Lewis and Clark. He was looking for gold, and he went back to Spain in shame because he didn't find the seven cities of gold that everybody believed was here. And historians would say, well, why would he be out there looking for gold? Duh. What did Cortez find in Mexico City? What did Pizarro find in Peru? They made Spain the richest country in the world, all the gold they found. Of course people would believe there was more further north and more further south and more they hadn't found yet. And that's what the Spaniards were doing for hundreds of years before the Mormons came. And that history's pretty clear. You know, they teach you in school that the, you know, our first Thanksgiving around 1616 or 1620, around then, that, you know, that's when the first Europeans were setting on the North American continent. Well, shoot, there were 10,000 Spaniards in Santa Fe at that time when we had our first Thanksgiving. There were a lot of Europeans in America when those pilgrims arrived. They weren't the first by any means.
Lee Nelson, he's the author of The Storm Test.
Anyway, I get carried away, Doug. I'm sorry.
It's great. Well, that's the idea. Lee's got two books in the in that series, the Storm Testament series, Storm Gold and Wakara, which touch on the stories of gold in Utah. He joined us from his home. Lee, thanks very much.
He's got a new book we're coming out with around December called The Utah's Lost Mines and Hidden Treasures, and he's just found so many neat things, and he even found a gold bar once. It had mixtures of silver and copper in it, but...
Say the name, Lee. We didn't hear the name of the author you were mentioning.
Stephen Schaefer.
Lee, we're glad you joined us. Thanks very much.
Hey, thanks, Doug.
We're going to take a break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There's a legend in Utah that somewhere hidden in the mountains that surround the Great Basin, there is gold, great veins of the stuff, or at least huge caches buried deep inside the earth. The story has it this is Spanish gold, discovered and mined by Spanish explorers and abandoned centuries ago. In some rural Utah counties, there are still people who hold tight to this story, say they've seen something, if not the gold itself, at least the maps or the trails. Today on the program, we're exploring this legend and other legends of lost gold in Utah's history. Let's take a few phone calls. Robert is joining us from Salt Lake. Hi, Robert.
Hi. I'm a descendant of Thomas Rhodes, and when these books have started to get published, I've noticed that there is a flurry of telephone calls that start happening in my family. And gold diggers, I thought that had gone out, you know, back in the 1800s or so, but they seem to come out of the woodworks and start making telephone calls thinking that my family, for some reason, has copies of these lost mines maps and that we will show them up to the mountains and show them where they are. But I just want to let everyone know that if these mines do exist, we have no such maps. And
you mean it's no longer in the Rhodes family, that the firstborn or whatever didn't get this
as I am the firstborn of the Rhodes clan. I don't have any of those maps. So,
but was this part of your family history? I mean, was there ever a point when they said, yeah, Grandpa Rhodes did have, you know, Caleb or Thomas passed something along?
Definitely. Caleb supposedly had those maps, and when he offered to pay off the national debt, and was turned away from that, they supposedly he just kept it to himself and died with the information. And we've wondered where they were ever since. And ever since they changed the name from Camas to Camas from the Rhodes Flat up there, it's just been kind of a legend that's been passed down the family. But we get a ton of phone calls, and we're hoping that we won't get them this time when this new book comes out.
Right. Well, brace yourselves. I guess the message is don't call. We don't know anything.
We don't know anything. That's right.
Robert, we're glad you called.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. Stephen is with us in Salt Lake. Hi, Stephen.
Hi. First off, I want to make it clear that I'm a big fan of people having fun out in the mountains. I know whenever I'm in Escalante country, if I see an interesting piece of wood, I scratch Everett Roos 1932 in it and put it in an alcove and hope somebody will find it and think it's evidence of something someday. But on this gold, the thing that I've never understood about it, and it seems so fundamentally silly, is that starting with the Spanish conquest, and you can certainly see this in the literature regarding it, everybody who was came in here was under control of the came into the North America basically was under control of the King of Spain. They had this system of, I believe the word is encomiendas, where they would give the soldiers grants of land and mineral rights and so on, and split them with the Spanish. And whatever people were doing here from Cortez on, they had priests looking over their shoulder, and they had Spanish tax collectors looking over their shoulders. And if you've read, for example, a conquest book by Hugh Thomas, those records are still sitting there in Sevilla in Spain, because not only did they fight for 2 or 3 years and for Mexico, but then they sued each other for the soldiers sued each other for rights to the plunder for about 25 years after that. And if there ever really was Spanish gold found here, maybe you wouldn't see records in Utah, but you'd sure see them, I would think, either in Mexico City or in Sevilla in Spain, or in Santa Fe, because there were taxes being collected and there were souls being saved, and the Spanish didn't move anywhere without doing that kind of stuff. And I've just always wondered why, when we talk about gold in Utah's hills, and there's obviously a lot of white salamander hunting that's been going on here for a long time, why people don't talk about what the Spanish record is.
So you think that's part of the story of this legend, is that there's what? That there's a kind of there's a desire to believe this, that there's that this adds to, gives it kind of a mythic proportion or something?
Well, if you get into, for example, the early history, not just of the Mormon Church, but of the whole, what they called, I believe, the burned over district in upstate New York and New England, digging for money, you know, digging for gold in the ground was a one of the most popular outdoor sports going. I mean, certainly a lot of the founders of the church did that, and, you know, the evidence of the white salamander legends are part of that. So it's certainly not surprising that a lot of holes got dug in these mountains, both by people, you know, dealing with various kinds of hallucinations, and by a lot of actual miners. So you'd think that if this stuff was real, somebody would have seen it somewhere, and somebody could present some proof that to a skeptic and not say it's all been lost. Mm. So I hope maybe you'll have somebody who'll come on and talk about that.
We just might. Thanks, Stephen.
Thank you.
Glad you called. Speaking of that, Will Bagley is with us, a writer and an historian, editor of the 15-volume History Kingdom in the West, Mormons in the American Frontier. Will, welcome. Welcome back.
Good to be here. Good.
Ken Sanders is also with us. Ken's the owner of Ken Sanders Rare Books and its in-house publishing company, Dream Garden Press. The press was founded in 1980 when it published its first title, which happened to be Footprints in the Wilderness by Gail Rhodes and Kerry Ross Boren, dealing with some of those lost gold mines. Ken, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Doug.
Well, let's start with I was going to go in another direction, but Stephen raises that question of – that Will Bagley, I wanted you to start by addressing this idea that it's sort of in our blood, maybe to want to believe some of these things. What do you make of the story and how it seems to persist?
Well, treasure stories are all over America, and in Utah, there's sort of a genetic predisposition to believe them, and a lot of the tales in Utah involve Nephite gold or Lamanite gold that will at some point save the church. It seems to be a pretty common thread throughout a number of the different mine and dream mine stories about how the church will desperately need money someday and the magical mines will save them. But the trouble is, all the evidence that people claimed and point to doesn't add up with what we know about the reality. Were there Spanish traders up in this country before Father Escalante? Probably a few of them. But to come up here to trade, you had to have real fair cojones. Because the Utes were very aggressive people. They did not tolerate being messed around with well. They were interested in trade, however, so there were probably a few traders. But there's no record of gold coming into Santa Fe from here. We know there were a lot of slaves taken to Santa Fe. But you simply don't have any valid physical evidence.
This idea of Spanish smelting operations and remnants of these vast mining processing plants, those kinds of things. What do you think that's all about?
Well, I completely discounted all the gold stories, but I spoke to the Utah Gold Miners Association once, and I told them that I thought all these stories were a lot of nonsense. But they said, well, Utah gold has a different, its own set of qualities. It's what they call pockety, and it'll be found in these concentrated pockets. And so it doesn't take much processing. And what people are talking about is...
Is that true, by the way, or is that part of the legend?
I think it's true.
Okay.
But again, finding those pockets is... it's easy with a metal detector, but otherwise it's very tough. And there may have been some Spaniards who did pick up some gold, but the notion that it could have amounted to much is just silly. And the notion that they were actually processing gold up here and running, I think they're called aristas, which is essentially you have a mule going around in a circle using stones to grind the ore, then you wash the ore out, or making silver bars or metal or gold bars, is really silly because the most prominent and easy to get metal in Utah is silver, and the silver in Park City was sticking out of the ground. So the notion that these guys would be finding these elusive pockets and then milling them and then melting them down into gold bars and then transporting them over the vast highway that the Aztecs opened up when they delivered Montezuma's treasure. It just doesn't make sense. And it's like these stories about cannons and cannonballs. If you know what the Spanish Trail was, and I'd like to briefly on why the Spanish Trail went through Green River.
Yeah.
It went through Green River because you crossed the Colorado River in about two places, actually three. Father Escalante found one at Crossing of the Fathers, but you weren't going to run a pack train through Crossing of the Fathers. John D. Lee lived at Lee's Ferry, where there's an adequate crossing, but the best ford was at Green River, and it was the ford that American explorers used. It was the ford used by the Spanish Trail. And the reason people went that far north wasn't to come up and collect gold. It was because you had the Grand Canyon and you had the Apaches. And you simply couldn't get a pack train through that country.
Let me ask you, Ken Sanders, how do you describe the people who – it seems like there's a real kind of – you talked about there's a religious fervor almost in this, I guess, kind of subculture of believers. How do you describe – these people?
Oh, there's no question there is. When I owned the Cosmic Airplane bookstore in the 1970s, one of the most sought-after books we could never keep in stock was this little green hardbound that Kerry Ross Bourne and Gail Rhodes had published of Footprints in the Wilderness. And in the late 70s, Gail Rhodes wandered into the bookshop and he'd spent most of the past decade doing this huge revised manuscript edition of their earlier work.
Now, Gail was Thomas's great-great-grandson or something?
Yeah, I think there are two, I forget, yeah. I think two greats in there. And Kerry Ross Bourne is related somehow, too. I forget the exact genealogy.
He's also the King of Ireland.
Be that as it may. So inadvertently, I kind of started I had so much demand for this old book that we quickly printed 5,000 copies in 1980, sold them out, printed 5,000 paperbacks in 1984, sold those out. But the interest was just astounding. And I guess my personal perspective, you can't help – it's like liking a good ghost story. You can't but help like a good lost gold mine story. And despite the lack of historical evidence and just total incongruities like this notion of these ancient Spanish symbols carved on Quaken aspen trees that go back hundreds of years. Well, I'm no botanist, but I have a hard time with that one. All these photographs in the book, you know, they're carved on Quakeys.
Yeah, a lot of them.
But it is, it's a mystical religious fervor, and it's just, you can't help if you delve into the lore, which I consider it to be, you can't help but get captivated and interested in these phantasmical tales.
585 West is the number to join the conversation. Let's go back to the phones. Dave is with us in Salt Lake. Hi, Dave.
Hi. I'm glad to hear I'm not the only cynic.
I don't think you are.
I got a hold of one of those early copies of Footsteps in the Wilderness. I've had a number of people try to buy it off me, too, but I read that, and my problem was on the tail end. If Rhodes took out all the gold that it says in that book, we're talking many, many tons of pure gold. So my next question is, well, what happened to it? And some people say, well, the Mormons made gold coins. Well, I know they did, but Rush's Coins published a book on Utah money, and he talked about the coins, and he gave the exact numbers of the ones they printed. They didn't make that many. And so other people say, well, they used it to gild the insides of the temple. I had an old bookbinder friend who said, gold leaf goes a very long way, and it wouldn't take much to do that. And so, you know, I'll say again, where did it go? And the only the people that I say this to, their last answer to me is, well, the Mormons have it stashed in their vaults up Little Cottonwood Canyon. And I just kind of have to smile and say, well, okay. If all this gold was found by Rhodes, where is it? Where'd it go?
Mm. Dave, we're glad you called. Thomas Rhodes, Will Bagley, explain who he was. He's a prominent figure in this story.
Oh, he's a great historical character. He was born in 1794. He was a veteran of the War of 1812. He was one of the earliest Mormon converts in 1832. He lived in Missouri. And what I find fascinating about Rhodes is that when all the other Mormons evacuate after the threat of the extermination order, Rhodes stays. And what's most puzzling is that in 1846, Thomas Rhodes goes overland not directly with the Donner Party, but in the same major migration. And one of the puzzles about Brigham Young's immigration is no scouting. There was apparently no reconnaissance done by the Mormons. But there's a legend, and unfortunately, despite great efforts by a wonderful Rhodes descendant named Bernie Rhodes, we've been unable to establish whether Rhodes talked to Brigham Young. We don't have any record of that. But allegedly, Rhodes went to Nauvoo, talked to Brigham Young. The fact that he'd been living in Missouri as a slave owner indicates he might have been something of a spy, that he would be giving reports to the Mormons about what the Missourians were planning. But the theory is that Brigham Young then commissioned Thomas to explore the route west. And in fact, the whole Rhodes clan moves out, and he has, I think, five or six sons. And Rhodes goes into the Salt Lake Valley, he and a member of the Donner Party, the first Mormons to come through Salt Lake, and goes over the Hastings Cutoff. But his son, John, goes up through Fort Hall, which was the other route. And it's almost as if they are indeed scouting the trail. A problem with the scouting theory is, though, that once they got to California, they stayed. They didn't apparently send back any reports. There's no mention or even an awareness, apparently, by Brigham Young that Rhodes was there. So,
but it's in California where he, in fact, does find actual gold.
Oh, yes, yes. And that is, in fact, where it's California gold that the Mormons mint in 1848 and 1849. It's not Thomas's gold. Thomas stays in California until 1849, and then he leads a large train of Mormons, I think 20, 25 wagons, back to Salt Lake. And all the later 49er journals talk about running into the Mormons. And I've tracked them going up the trail, and they tell all kinds of stories. And I think they're nervous about being robbed. And they first of all, show all this gold to people, and the 49ers are all delighted because they're in rough shape by then, but there's physical evidence. But later on, they're more and more guarded about what they tell people. But Rhodes came to Utah. He had $17,000.
In gold, right?
In gold.
Yeah.
And apparently, it sounds like he gave it to Brigham Young, or at least a substantial part of it, or at least he'd brought back the tithing that Mormons had paid. But so there's the start. It does have a historical reality. And Rhodes is a loyal frontier Mormon. Settles up in Heber Valley, settles down in Kane County. He's one of these guys that's always out there on the frontier. But he finally dies in Minersville in 1869. Stone broke. He's apparently doesn't have an enormous amount of wealth, doesn't have huge stocks of gold. And the tradition is carried on by one of his sons, Caleb. We can talk about Caleb some later maybe, but they're great stories. And I think Caleb really is the start of the legendary gold mines.
From Kyle, he writes, "Here's my story, passed on from Grandpa Jack, salty old feller with a voice like gravel, looks fit for Hollywood. Used to tell a couple of tall tales, or maybe they really were the truth, about some finds down south near Milford in southern Utah. The first was of a huge cave filled with precious amethyst crystals up on a hill called Molly's Nipple. As a kid, I remember looking up there thinking someday I'd be the one destined to find that long-lost treasure trove. The other one concerned a good-sized stone or rock with a 1776 on it. He surmised it was carved by Father Escalante and his group when they passed up through the valley, which, in fact, was the year he was supposed to have passed through. Also thought it was cool as it was the same date as our country's founding." Tristan writes this email, "Ever since I can remember, my dad has been on the hunt for the bars of gold allegedly buried in the South. Although he's quite ill and bedridden now, when he was younger, he used to load up his truck and trailer with ropes and shovels, flashlights, food and water, and head out for a weekend adventure. At one point, he even bought a huge mining machine that's rusting in the backyard as I write this because it's too large to haul. Although Dad would always come home from his expeditions with empty pockets, his enthusiasm never waned. Now that he's physically unable to go on these adventures, the idea or the dream of this hidden gold, I believe, helps keep his heart pounding." Let's go back to the phones. Jim is with us, calling from Salt Lake. Hi, Jim.
Hi, yes, it's great to be on the show.
Thank you.
And I guess I wanted to pull back a little bit because we seem to have gone into Mormon land. But let's go back to the original premise of the show. Which was the original Spanish possible presence, and I think to me, you know, I'm an agnostic as far as the lost gold mines, but as far as the Spanish presence in Utah, I think that's very interesting, and it's something that's really not taught or talked about. And so, I would like to talk about the Spanish presence a little more. I wouldn't be surprised if they didn't find an outcropping of gold here and there as they camped. I'm sure some of the outcroppings looked interesting to the Spaniards, and I'm sure they did find some trinkets or killed some Indians and found a lot of trinkets. But as far as lost gold mines, if anybody's ever been to an old abandoned gold mine, the reason it's abandoned is because there's nothing there. People don't leave gold in mines. They take it out of mines, and they put it in, often they bury it, or they put it in the bank, or they take it to the mint and have it minted. So I guess, you know, the Barrick Gold Mining Corporation is still taking about thousands of pounds worth of gold out of Mercure Canyon in present day. That's where most of the gold is coming out of Utah. So I it's just interesting how fact mixes with fiction.
Yeah.
And it's particularly interesting to me is the Spanish presence, and I just wanted to make that point.
So what you're saying is, you know, while you may not think that there's this great cache of gold somewhere in the Uinta Mountains, you think that there's got to be some kernel of something there that makes the story have started in the first place.
correct. Well, I would expect a graveyard. If there were some kind of large encampment, I would expect a graveyard or that. But then you think of the U.S. looking for Osama bin Laden, and you think of the Uinta Basin, and we're talking about almost, you know, the same area. Yeah. So it's also not unthinkable that there are artifacts there that haven't been found.
Well, Will Bagley, you concede there's maybe something that to the, there being some Spanish before the explorers that we knew about.
Well, I've seen some indications that there were I read a letter written for the Utes by a Spanish trader named Martinez. And he says he knew Wakara when he was a child, which would have put him back in Utah to the 1830s. But history, real history, is not what happened. It's what we have records of what happened. And this Mexican presence in Utah, because it would have been Mexicans by this time, doesn't seem to have been all that strong. And it was based not on gold mining, but it was based on trade, Indian trade and trade for slaves. And what we do know, you know, Lee Nelson was saying that we know that there was this slaughter of Spaniards in 1840 by the Utes. Well, we do have actual records of European and Utes in the Uinta Basin. Fort Davy Crockett had been set up by American fur traders. Antoine Roubidoux was running Fort Winty on the Uinta River in the 1840s, and he was run out. And I think that some of these realities get confused. But what you don't have in the fur trade records, the actual records, is much reference to Spanish. Hmm. Now, in terms of the physical evidence, oh, there's hundreds of pits up there. There's digging. There's all this evidence of mining. No kidding. Because in the late 19th century, everybody and his brother was coming through Utah hoping to find the big strike. And it is not at all surprising. What is a little appalling is that you got these stories about some clown going up in the mountains above Springville and digging out a treasure cave. Well, who owned that cave? My guess is the Forest Service. So this clown was up destroying what might have been an important archaeological site. Maybe that topsoil was actually the remnants of old campsites. How would he know? He was looking for gold. And there is such an element of irrationality. Ken has great stories about what these gold books are really about. And the question is, where's the gold?
Ken, talk about that, would you, some of these stories?
Well, it's...
tell us who George Thompson is along
George Thompson is another author. His first book was published in 1968 by Deseret Book, Treasure Mountain Home, A History of Mining in Park City, that I later expanded and revised, and that started me publishing the George Thompson books. George was a sweetheart of a man. He's called Tommy Thompson, or Snowshoe Tommy. He was a mining brat raised in old Park City, and I think there's even a restaurant at Deer Valley named Snowshoe Tommy's these days. And George just had a believable lust and interest in all of these stories and mines. And before he was unfortunately killed, he, in a car wreck, 10 or 12 years ago, he had actually moved up and bought a little house in Heber to be closer to the action. And he's the one that went out into the Uinta Basin with the famed treasure hunter Mel Fisher. And, oh, he was so excited after that. And George used to have what I can tell you that's real, because I've seen it, is George had a gold nugget. Now, he used to do show and tell with it and do little talks at groups and clubs. I can't tell you where the gold came from. George, of course, maintained it was from the Uintas and was one of these. There's not just one Lost Roads mine. There are legion.
Sure.
There's the sacred Carrie Chenaub, the alleged Indian one. And then the Spanish ones, it wasn't so much that they were, I think, smelting the mines allegedly here, as that they were hauling up these vast tonnages of gold bars and burying them in the Uintas. That seems like that's kind of backwards to me.
Or hauling cannonballs up here. But why would you haul cannonballs, which are hugely heavy? And you know what? If you could get a cannon up here, you could fire rocks with it.
And how did you do all of this stuff? I mean, hard rock mining is a very invasive process. And then in addition to where did the gold go, what about this notion, how on earth, if there were these tons of gold, did one guy on a mule haul this stuff? Have you ever actually lifted a gold bar? Holy moly, these things weigh a lot. You're not going to get one or two, maybe, if you were really strong.
And remember, the Aztecs could not have carted away Montezuma's treasure because they didn't have wheels. They would have had to use an enormous human caravan, and there isn't the slightest historical evidence, except the legends that the Aztecs were managed to make off with the gold, that actually happened. Cortez got his hands on the gold, and he killed a lot of people to do it.
Let's go back to the phones. Brett is with us in Salt Lake City. Hi, Brett.
Hi. My grandfather, who knew about, and you can even see it to this day, there's a stand of spruce trees, and right as you come into Fruitland, that is as square can be. And we know how nature abhors a right angle and a straight line. And there's no explanation for why that stand of trees is there, but he claims that he went up there and there was a pit, a hole in the ground, and he thought, oh, this is it, I found the gold.
Right.
And he threw some rocks down the hole, and all he heard was the buzzing of rattlesnakes. The hole was just full of rattlesnakes. So everyone in my family are certain that that hole is where one of those mines is, and what better way to protect it than fellow with snakes?
That's great. I won't ask you what you believe, Brett, but the fact is it's part of your family lore, right?
Yeah, I mean, exactly, and I am a bit of a skeptic. My dad used to preach the gospel out of that Footsteps in the Wilderness book.
Yeah.
And he's one of these believers who thinks that, you know, the golden plates were even made out of that gold.
Yeah. So, Brett, we're glad you called.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Thanks so much. 585 West, again, the number 585-9378, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Ken, you're showing me a map?
Well, all of these books, including the ones I've published over the years, several by George Thompson and Gail Rhodes and Boren, they all have these crudely hand-drawn maps of areas of the Uintas, and they all dutifully have X marks the spot. Now, if you've ever spent any time out in that country, using this map with a few little squiggles and some trees and some ridge lines and maybe a creek and a couple of place names, you think it's hard to find a Boy Scout lost in the Uintas.
People swear by them, though, right? I mean, these are...
Well, yes, though there's also all of these legends and rumors that likely are true that Rhodes and Thompson and others deliberately, of course, withheld secret information and even went so far as to publish the wrong maps to throw people off the trail.
If you had a map to a gold mine, why publish it?
Well, go ahead.
Ken and I have a mutual friend, an old Park City hand, who was a good friend of George's, and he said, George was making this stuff up. But tell him about Kerry Shinob or whatever, the gold cave and the Wakara skeleton.
Well, in one of Boren's more fanciful gold mine books, I can't even recall which title one because they're so prolific now, he has this, I wished we had it to read the passage from it, this amazing account of finding the sacred Kerry Shinob. And, of course, he's got a sacred trust to never reveal it, even though he's been in it. And he describes walking through this tunnel of pure gold that he was a little uncertain whether it was carved out of solid gold or was gold-plated. And then he went through treasure room after treasure room with Spanish armor and skeletons and treasure chests full of rubies and emeralds and precious gems as well. And then at the very end of the tunnel is a bony skeleton in Spanish armor, clutching a first edition Book of Mormon with a letter from Brigham Young stuck inside of it.
Now, it's Wakara.
That's a great. It reads more now, like science fiction.
If we could talk to Kerry, who's in prison, I think, for murdering his wife, the question I would ask him is, forget about the gold. You couldn't have carried that out. We know, but why didn't you take the first edition Book of Mormon?
Let me ask you, gentlemen, finally, because we don't have much time left. I want to go back to the email we got from Tristan and her father and the fact that this kept him going on weekends, that he had this kind of beautiful dream. That's part of this legend, is it not? And it's in something about it, while it might seem funny or silly or ridiculous, there's something kind of touching and nice about believing in that fantasy, do you think?
But it's based on greed. My wife is going to publish a book with USU, the memoirs of a Ute woman named Rose Daniels. Her husband was Aaron Daniels, who Daniels Canyon's named after, an early settler up in the Heber Basin. And in his memoir, he describes being taken by Caleb to the Lost Roads mine. And he was an absolute believer in it, and who knows what Caleb was showing people. But, and this is classic Lost Roads story, he left Rose a map. And what did Rose do with a map? She burned it.
Doug, there's always going to likely be a lot more money continue to be made off the sale of books about the Lost Roads and other gold mines than there ever will be from the gold. Though, to play just a quick devil's advocate, what if somebody, setting aside the disbelief, what if somebody actually did discover some old Spanish gold or nuggets or something up in the Uintas, given the land ownership issues, state, federal, Indian, given the environmental laws, given the government trying to come in and take a large portion or all of the money? If you were a smart treasure hunter and you found the Lost Roads mine, would you tell anyone?
And the Utes are the guys in black helicopters kill you anyway.
Will Bagley, historian and the editor of Kingdom in the West, Mormons in the American Frontier. Ken Sanders, of course, the owner of Ken Sanders Rare Books. Gentlemen, thanks very much for joining us. Radio West is a production of KUER News. The program is directed by Mike Anderson, produced by Elaine Clark. And I'm Doug Fabrizio.